Welcome back to Portrait of an Editor. I am Francis Lombard. A reminder that there is a Portrait of an Editor Patreon page where you can find all the older interviews all the way back to 2017. I just moved a bunch of my interviews over there and added a new outtake, so check out everything for just a buck a month on the Portrait of an Editor Patreon page. We also have a sponsor for this episode, which is Magic Mind, which is a great productivity drink, and we will talk about that later. In this Portrait of an Editor, Dave Wilgus discusses his move from the East Coast to the West Coast and his journey from editor to writer. Along the way, we cover what could help you become an editor at DC Comics or Marvel, and the support he got from his folks in his hometown. Dave also let me ramble on about my obsession with DC Comics' 80-page giants and the importance of short stories like them for a writer's profile and for an editor to test out talent. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. So Dave, welcome to Portrait of an Editor. I guess the first thing, because this is something I've never had the opportunity to do, I grew up in Munson, Massachusetts. Of course, Everybody can look up my records, but you're from also Holyoke, right?
So Holyoke, Massachusetts.
Never, I don't think I've had anybody this close to home on, growing up and from the show. So if we won't be dropping our R's anytime soon because that's where we're from. So
yep.
After Worcester, people get our R's back. But
yes,
we might nerd out and maybe, I don't know, hey, Alex, the Patriots still are better than the Chargers. I don't know when you ever talked to him about it.
Yeah, we talk about it often. When we started working together as editors, he took me to a preseason Chargers and Rams game. Preseason games aren't like super exciting, but it was a great bonding experience, but it was the most boring football game I'd ever seen in my life.
So now we both like experienced the Boston, the aughts and into, the teens of enjoy this moment because we know how bad the Patriots used to be.
I tell people all the time, like in the 90s, sports were just the thing that made my dad upset, Yes. And it wasn't really until the Patriots snow game when things turned around when it was like, oh man, are sports for us? Sports going to make us happy? We had a really good run there, and the Celtics are great this year. But yeah, between the Red Sox and the Patriots, it's a far cry from where we were when we were winners.
Yeah. Well, I've reverted back to my childhood where I the Bruins and stuff when I came back.
Oh, I love the Bruins.
Yeah. I was watching the Bruins out in LA when I could get them, and then when I moved back here, I drove through Vegas and I put $5 down on the Bruins to win it all. And that was the end. They finally won it all. So, I just haven't won it again. So I got to get my butt back to Vegas and put some money down or something. So,
I normally wouldn't advocate for gambling, but based on the causality of that one game, I think you should. I think you should start sports gambling intensely.
Yes. Well, we can do it here now, actually, because as you know, the Blue Laws have sort of loosened up. So we could actually gamble. But let's talk.
You can do it anywhere.
I know, do it anywhere. So that's what people are going to get for the next 45 minutes of us just geeking on about being from Massachusetts. But it's good to meet you for the first time.
Thank you.
Let's get the one question out of the way. People hear Will Dennis and I talk about it in our newest episode of Cropped, which will drop before this episode. But right now, for timing wise, we're in the middle of this conversation regarding editor creativity and creators' creativity and who gets the cash? Who's responsible for what? How does an editor actually, the Roy Thomas issue with Wolverine? Will had a good discussion and then used Scalp as an example where it seems like, he put a lot into it, but it's Jason Aaron. And we talked about that. Tom Brevoort says, quotes Madman. It's like, that's why you get paid the money. You're an editor who's now a creator, And where do you land on this thing? Because you've probably experienced putting, a lot of idea, providing the core idea for whatever in your work, but also now you're a creator and you can see that you need that revenue stream just to pay the rent at times. So where do you land on this, the thing that's going on? and where do you know the discussion of, because back then when Wolverine was created, the editors and creators weren't as savvy as they are today.
Sure.
When it comes to all that, and the money isn't as big as it is today.
Yeah. I guess like the first thing I want to say is Roy Thomas created so much for Marvel Comics as a writer, right? Like we're talking about Vision and Ultron. So I guess the first thing was I was just kind of confused because I feel like if someone had done this to Roy over those characters, I would have had the same reaction, which is that doesn't sit right with me having been an editor who is now a writer. As editors, like we go to people sometimes with half a premise or half an idea, or we go to somebody and say, hey, I'm looking to create a new character. Let's work on it together. But ultimately, like the whatever equity, depending on what company you work for, the creators get should go to the creators. You know, being on staff, you literally get like health insurance and a retirement plan. And, you know, whether you work for Marvel or DC for a long time, like you ultimately get a ton of benefits that creators don't. You might not necessarily get as much credit as the creators do. And like, you know, former X-Men editor Bob Harris once said to me, editors get all the blame and none of the credit. And that's probably how it should be. You know, really savvy folks like you and when I was a kid realized like, hey, there's editors who make the work I like, and you kind of can start to follow them. Will Dennis was certainly an editor I followed. And when I wanted to intern at DC, someone I wrote a letter to because I liked his work so much. But to get back to the Roy of it all, I didn't like it when I heard it. I was disappointed. And it just, when you're the editor, I don't think you should be getting equity in a character. I think there's a ton of other ways the company can and should empower and incentivize you. And that's a corporate America thing, not just a comic book creative thing. And I'm not saying the editors don't deserve more than the same way creators don't deserve more, but I don't think editors deserve creator credit on characters. Unless you were like in that murky place where you're a writer on staff, but that's not really been a thing since like the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and Roy having the opportunity to be an editor and then also a writer at the same time, you know, that double dipping aspect, I'm glad the company's moved away from that. But yeah, you just reminded me, you know, he and as I think Will even mentioned, you know, Roy created and did so much, and it's just this one character, the one character who's the biggest character, you know, next to Spider-Man and Superman and Batman is Will.
Yeah.
And is this a cash grab all of a sudden, even though, you know, there's been money paid out for all the other creations that Roy's done and the stories that he's been involved in, you know, the movies that have the Spider-Man movies, you know, were based on and stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. It's why now? Why now? And why really?
Yeah. And I think the other thing that makes it complicated, and again, like, I don't know Roy. I have a lot of respect for him as an editor and a writer and, you know, as a person who is essential to the history of American comics, but like, I think the other complicated thing is like none of those people who are also listed as creators can speak for themselves, right?
Yes.
And can argue for themselves. And that's the part that feels really, really complicated because it's like we can't even really have a discussion. There's only one person's perspective and, you know, maybe whoever else was alive when that was going on. But, you know, Herb Trimpe, John Romita Sr. and Len Wein can't speak for themselves in the conversation.
And you know. And there's also the reporting that was done back then too, doesn't really, there's no clear, you know, you can't go back to the reporting and people, the questions over the decades of people asking Roy questions about the creation of Wolverine, X-Men and everything. It's not even clear enough that I've been able to see what little, you know, that people posted that really are, says yes, there is, he does have a stake in this character beyond just his involvement as an editor and stuff. Right. It doesn't seem to be clear. So here's the discussion. And now it's, yeah. And yes. So, well, thank you for that. Thank you.
Sure.
Switching, seeing you're a new editor, a new guest. growing up in Massachusetts, what got you into comic books?
It's interesting. You were just talking about Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, and Wolverine. It was definitely like growing up in the early 90s on like the Fox Kids television lineup, which had X-Men, the animated series, Batman, the animated series, and eventually Spider-Man, the animated series. Like, I learned about these characters from those awesome cartoons. And once those cartoons went away, like, I was aware that these characters existed in comic books. So I, like, you know, started to find comics that, like, my local Toys R Us, and eventually like local like collectible stores. And I was a really weird kid in the sense that, like, because Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, the X-Men existed on TV, I thought like I was getting ripped off if I bought those comics. So I bought the comics for the characters who would like guest star on those shows, who didn't have their own shows, like The Flash or Captain America, Justice League. I thought it was like gaming the system by like getting the characters who didn't have TV shows, because I just assumed if I read Superman, Batman, I was like, no, I see those guys every week. It's the same thing, right? Eventually learning that, you know, it's the source material, but it is widely different. And then as a teenager, I had the great fortune of growing up when the graphic novel and collected editions boom really happened. And you could get so many essential comics through like Barnes and Noble. So you didn't necessarily have to go to a comic book store to get into the hobby. Eventually you'd have to go there to become a Wednesday warrior, but excuse me. At first it was like, I remember a big trip to Barnes and Noble and when I was like 11, where I got like Grant Morrison, Howard Porter's JLA, Jeff Johns, Leonard Kirk and David Goyer on JSA, Mark Waid and Howard Porter on Fantastic Four. And like, you know, everyone says like every comic could be someone's first. I'm just lucky that the comics I picked were like pretty great, and like they like set the tone for what I liked moving forward. And then I came of age in the early 2000s when Marvel and DC were having an incredibly great creative streak, like the lead up to Infinite Crisis at DC and at Marvel, like, you know, going from Marvel Knights to the rebirth of Marvel with like new X-Men by Morrison and Frank Quitely, Fantastic Four by Mark Waid and Mike Waringo, and then leading into like the 10-year event cycle that Brian Bendis and Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction, Olivia Coppel, Jim Chung, so many phenomenal creators kind of oversaw and architected. I just kind of kept digging deeper and finding more comics. And eventually, after loving the superhero stuff, but realizing like not all the superhero books are great at the same time, you start reaching out and reading books by creators you like and discovering the creator-owned work, finding things like Vertigo and Image Comics and Oni Press and Dark Horse, and just still loving superhero characters, loving superhero comics, but also loving creators and loving all types of comics and what the medium is capable of.
So you came of age during the aughts, and as I like to say, like Marvel was, you know, the what is it? The inmates were running the asylum, basically, at Marvel, really. And the creative craziness at times, it just, you know, ended up burning out at times. But, you know, when at one point, so yeah, there was this mass and then, you know, focus on comics and just a lot of great creativity going on at that point. When did you decide that, like, I want to do this for a job? Because compared to like my coming up is like, how do you, when I started reading comics, I just like, you wrote a letter into the letter column. So, but when was the shift of like, I'm going to pursue this as a job? And basically, how did you map that out? Were you looking at you're a writer now, but did you go, I want to be an editor first? Or did you just, I want to engage with these folks and go to some conventions and see what's going on? But yeah, could you sort of give us some detail on that?
For sure. I think, you know, when I was really young, before you kind of can read the comic book credits properly, I just assumed that one person did every job. So originally I wanted to be a cartoonist, but for a variety of reasons, like I didn't have what it took to like be a cartoonist to draw. And I realized like, oh, I'm a writer. Like I'm a very hyperverbal person. I love like stories and outside comics. Like I'm a huge fan of like film and television. I'm just like obsessed with writing kind of as just like an art form, whatever method it takes. And I was pretty young when I knew that I wanted to make comics for a living. Like I was like in elementary school when I understood that, well, people do this for a living, like maybe I could do it for a living. And it was really in high school when I was at the peak of my comic book reading that you know, we didn't have letters columns the same way that you guys did, but we had the beginning of comic book podcasts, particularly for me, Word Balloon, hosted by John Suntress. Like every week I could listen to the people who were writing my favorite comics, like Brian Bendis, Greg Rucka, and Brubaker. These guys were on all the time. And not only were they talking about comics and how they broke in and how they started, but they were also talking about pop culture. So I learned about so many different types of movies and books and films, or I said films and movies, television, video games, all sorts of stuff from these folks. So like, you know, reading the comics and like listening to these podcasts really shaped like, yeah, I want to do this. I want to be a comic book writer. And I went to school for creative writing in New Jersey, mostly because like at the school I went to, you could take a train into New York City. And my goal was to like get internships at Marvel and DC. And I did ultimately intern at DC and Marvel, DC first and then Marvel. And I was like, well, I'm going to be a writer, but I want to see how this kind of machine works. And, you know, I'll also make connections. And I got to a point where I was at the end of college. And this was in 2014. And DC was looking for new assistant editors because they were going to be transitioning from New York City to Los Angeles. So they were reaching out to a bunch of interns who they'd had the last couple of years because we already were kind of partially trained in editorial stuff. And I took that job because I'd been writing every day since I was like 12 or 13, and I was making comics with friends and doing all that stuff. I had the revelation that I wasn't ready to make comics professionally. Like, I didn't feel like I was a good enough writer yet to do it. And also just economically, I'd made comics with some people and I'd paid them what I could, which wasn't very much. But I kind of realized like, this isn't going to happen for me right now. But if I become an editor, I can make comics and I can learn more about writing and storytelling and all this stuff. And maybe eventually I will get back to writing. But, you know, I just graduated from college. I really didn't want to move back with my parents. I had the chance to like live in New York and then in Los Angeles. And as like a 21-year-old kid, I was like, maybe we should go on the adventure and see what happens. And thankfully, writing came back around eventually.
Yeah, I think moving to LA instead of moving to New York as just winging it, because that's what I did. I just graduated from grad school and was young enough. And I'm like, everybody else is going, you know, so at least I know some people. But I moved to LA not knowing, you know, other than my classmates. That was it. Mm-hmm. You know, I had spent a lot of time going to New York, and like any, you know, got somebody, you probably could take the train from New York to New York all the time. I don't know. It just felt like LA was a little easier. So you basically signed on to DC when they were doing their move to LA?
Yeah. I started as a temporary assistant editor the last year they were in New York City. So I kind of got to work in the legendary office on Broadway in New York City. So, and there was no guarantee that like I was going to get signed on, but it was basically like, hey, like at least for a year, you'll get to do this job. And I was like, that sounds pretty cool. And I worked in the Batman editorial office with Mark Doyle, Chris Conroy, Rachel Gluckstern, and another great temp editor named Matt Humphreys. And then at the end of my time, I interviewed for the full-time editor, assistant editor position in Los Angeles. And they were like, hey, you got the job. Do you want to come with us? And then 9 years ago, literally 9 years ago, this past weekend, I moved to Los Angeles to take the full-time job with DC in LA, and I've lived here ever since.
Wow. So, Well, what do you think of the city?
I love it. I mean, it took a long time. It's tough to love when you first get here because you're a kid. You have no money. It's an expensive city. It's still an expensive city. But very quickly, you know, I loved the job. I loved the office we worked in every day. It was like, it looked like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory for comic books. Mm-hmm. And, you know, pretty quickly, I started doing things like taking improv classes at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in Los Angeles and like meeting people who didn't make comics and going to comedy shows and doing comedy shows all over LA. So like very quickly, I had an excuse to like drive all over the city every weekend. And also, I was really lucky that I started working at DC with a bunch of people who were my age. So we all came out here together. And that first 2 years, like we were just driving around having adventures, like after work, like going to different comic stores, trying different restaurants, you know, going to like the Arclight for the first time, like doing all these things like together, kind of as like a class of editors. And I'm really lucky that most of those people still work at DC and I'm still friends with them. So it was, while economically it wasn't always the easiest, like, you know, I fell in love with this place pretty quickly. And even on your worst day, I'd walk outside and I'd turn to my right and be like, the Warner Brothers studios to my right, the Disney studios to my left. I did okay. You know, I've already gotten pretty far in this dream of like making things for a living, even if there's days that are like really challenging and hard.
I have to say, yeah, settling into Burbank. Do you live in Burbank or are you in?
Not too far off. I live in the North Hollywood, the gem of the San Fernando Valley, right next to Burbank.
So yeah, Burbank is a nice, like, ease you into Los Angeles. It's not too crazy. It empties out in the evening. So if you want to do stuff in the evening, it's like parking's not that bad. At least what I remember. It's been when I lived there. I know the city, the moment I left is around the time that you arrived, and it all of a sudden got really expensive. It was a little cheaper back in the day for me. But
yeah,
Burbank's, yeah, it settles it. And Mark Chiarello gave me a tour of DC.
Oh, and the greatest.
That building is just, the setup you guys had was like, it's a fantasy. I walk in there, it's like, oh, I feel like a little kid again. It was just, everything was just, it was like a shrine to everything that DC's done. Everything, you know, that first, you know, the first iteration of the offices in Burbank.
Yeah. I mean, and even being in the office, like, hey, if I'm having a bad day, like, take a walk around the floor and like every like editor and higher level person like Mark Chiarello has an office with a sliding glass door. And on that sliding glass door is a piece of famous comic book art. So you're walking by Jack Kirby drawings of the New Gods or Brian Bolland Animal Man covers or whatever. And you're just like, again, I'm here and I need to have some perspective about how amazing this all is.
So you jumped in, you moved to LA. Mm-hmm. Did you have, you worked at the, do you feel that the only way to become an editor for Marvel and DC is to do an internship? Because of previous conversations I've had and even experiences that I had, it seems that being an intern at one of these, if you want to work there, you have to, an internship really gives you a legs up. And with all the interviews I've done, I don't know of anybody I've talked to who's been an editor other than Will Dennis, who just got a phone call from Shelley Bond to come over. But his situation is unique. He was a little bit older and Vertigo is a different fish than the Marvel or DC universe. What do you think about that?
I think that having been an intern is a really strong way to go. Like if you told me like, hey, my dream is to be a comic book editor, I would say, go get an internship. Mm-hmm. I will say, like, I've seen people take other avenues. Some people you've interviewed, like Andy Curry, obviously was like the editor in chief of Comics Alliance for many years. And I think his perspective on comics, and also he had a wonderful weekly Friday feature where he posted a bunch of comic art where a lot of artists or a lot of editors would find new comic artists. People were like, Andy seems like he has a head for this job. Likewise, I worked with people like Brian Cunningham and Mike Cotton and the late Pat McCallum, who all worked for Wizard Magazine. So I would say, like, if you don't have an internship in comics, which I do think is the best track to becoming an editor, becoming a writer, a reviewer, a critic, you know, is not a bad alternate road to take, or working in some other form of publishing. I think, especially lately, you know, Marvel and DC and all these comic book companies have gotten better about expanding their horizons in terms of who they're looking for. And they've done that in their internship programs as well. But yeah, I mean, if you're listening to this interview and you're like, my great dream is to be an editor, I would say then definitely, definitely try to get an internship at Marvel or DC or another comic book company, because there's tons of them now.
What do you think it is that they're looking for, the basic stuff? I mean, because one thing I've heard is being able to handle the workload. Do you feel you have to be aware and be realistic about the amount of work you're going to be juggling? And I think the internship exposes you that too. But is there anything else that the internship, that at your core, that it exposes you to, that really helps you get, you know, could help you get a job and move up.
Yeah. I mean, I think the work ethic thing is the most important and most paramount thing. Like you see like, hey, like this person can show up every day and they're capable of taking feedback and doing work and like learning every day. And also, you know, just like any other setting, like you kind of want to make sure you're not working with someone who is like not awesome to be around all day. Like, you know, there's days in the comic book business where you're working 10, 11 hours and like, you don't want to be in the foxhole with somebody who you can't 100% trust or quite frankly, like jive with creatively. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we're all exactly the same creatively, but like you want to be around people who like are creative in a way that inspires you or in a way that you find interesting or that you think that comics really needs. I mean, you know, I was an intern, but when I was an editor, we had a wonderful intern named Marquise Draper, who was a cartoonist student. And we just thought he was the best. And he was so creative and wonderful. And he was also just great at doing the work. And he was just, we just knew he was kind of exceptional. And then, you know, a couple of years later, he's on staff. And now I believe he's an associate editor. And like, yeah, it's just great. And likewise, I do some editorial work at IDW now. And there's an editor who works there named Tia. And they were also a DC intern. And likewise, like we just knew that they were spectacular. They had done a lot of really critical writing about comics for their college. And when they were at DC, they were just always willing to do the work, ask really cool questions, and like gave us their perspective in a way that was like always interesting and never like inappropriate. Like sometimes when you want something really badly and you want to impress people, whether it's in a job or in any environment, like you can get a little too excited and be like, let me tell you everything I think about what's wrong with this. And you're like, okay. But like, you know, when someone can be like, hey, I have some thoughts about the way things are and I'd love to express them. And you listen, and you're like, I think this person would make comics a better place. Like you just get that vibe. Like an internship usually lasts like 3 months. And like, you can tell after 3 months if somebody kind of has what it takes to do this or if you want to bring them back in, quite frankly.
When did you feel as an editor, I mean, when you at DC, that you could really start expressing yourself? So let me to go through the timeline. It's like you did, you were, you had a year in New York, then you got the job and you moved. You got the job as an editor or as an associate editor?
I got the job as an assistant editor. Yeah.
As an assistant editor. When did you feel that you could make the move to be an editor? And I guess before that, when did you feel that you're able to really feel comfortable expressing yourself as you just, you know, like, you know, going back to that, what you just said earlier, of being able to really express yourself and express desires and also express your opinion as you tried to move up the ladder?
It took a couple of years and I had a lot of like insecurities I had to deal with. You know, I don't know if it would surprise you having grown up in Massachusetts, but I was a bit of a mouthy, insecure, willing to pick fights, Polish, Irish, Catholic kid. And, you know, being in that environment was both inspiring, but also like I was freaking out every day because I was like, I don't know if I deserve to be here.
And I really, Polish, Irish coming out of Holyoke? Nah.
Yeah. but no, I had to really like recalibrate and be like, you do deserve to be here. You need to kind of calm down and like acknowledge where you are. And I was lucky that I had great teachers. Like I had Mark Doyle and Chris Conroy, who were the editor and group editor at the Batman group when I was there. And they were great. But like two people who really took me under their wing as mentors and in a really meaningful way, in addition to Chris and Mark, were Alex Antone, who you've had on the show, who I worked with on DC's quarterly anthologies for about 3 years, and then Rebecca Taylor, who I worked with on the rebirth run of Nightwing. And on Nightwing, well, there's three things that happened that were really seminal. First, when we were doing DC Rebirth, which was, I believe, 2 or 2.5 years into my time as an assistant editor, if you remember about that initiative, we were doing books twice a month. So most of these books had to come out twice a month. So we had to reinstitute something called an inventory story. An inventory story is basically a fully made comic you have in a drawer that you're ready to publish in case your comic goes off the track schedule-wise. Because the thing about Rebirth was you could not be in the store twice a month. It was unacceptable. So Mark Doyle and Chris Conroy put me in charge of getting inventories for every comic in the Batman group. So I had to, I joked that I would call it my shadow government. But basically, I got to kind of make like issues of Batman, issues of Detective Comics, issues of Nightwing, issues of Batgirl, Harley Quinn, all of which eventually saw the light of day. But like, that was like a really great way for me to practice working with people who I liked, making comics and like having ideas in a way that was a very safe and controlled environment. And then on Nightwing, when I was Rebecca Taylor, we call her Tay, Tay's assistant editor. She was really like, I want your opinions. I want you to talk every time we do an issue. I want to hear your opinions about who we should be hiring for fill-ins. And I want you to, she was just like, I don't want you to be quiet. She was like, I want to hear what you have to say. And she really empowered me creatively to like speak up. And that was really important. And with Alex Antone, when we worked on the quarterly anthologies, like, I don't know how much he said on your interview, but like, we really viewed those as like an opportunity to just make the comics we wanted to make.
Yeah.
And Alex saw that I was so passionate about it that even though I was an assistant editor, he fought to get me a co-editor credit, which was really incredible. So it was really around that time doing inventories, working on Nightwing and doing those anthologies that really empowered me creatively. And then like, I got to learn how to make comics and I got to learn what I really thought about comics in a practical way. And with the anthologies, eventually that was the first place I also got to write. So those anthologies really changed my whole life.
You're talking the 80-page Giants,
the 80-page
right?
Giants, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Alex and I, yeah, there's a whole episode about that. It was a lot of fun and just craziness and sort of the what they allowed you to do and just the experimenting that they allowed you to do. One of the most rewarding things about this podcast is the opportunity that it has allowed me to meet new people. Some of the new folks I've met come from Magic Mind. They reached out to me regarding their productivity drink, Magic Mind, and I tried their product and really liked it, so we decided to team up. I've never been a big coffee fan, so I don't like drinking it throughout the day because of how the jitters fracture my focus, and energy drinks have never really worked for my taste buds or even heart health. They really are not good for me. So I was always on the lookout for something to help me keep a really good energy level throughout the full day of creative endeavors, chores, and all the spinning plates I have throughout my day. So after discovering Magic Mind, I now drink it a few hours after my morning coffee, and it helps me stay focused and creative throughout my very busy day. And with its all natural ingredients, such as matcha for energy, lion's mane mushroom, and other nootropics for focus and support, my basically like old brain. So it's a way I can avoid a lot of sugar in my diet and other negative impacts that I have experienced from energy drinks. And just before I get back to Dave, you can find Magic Mind Energy Drink at magicmind.com/portraitofaneditor. That's magicmind.com/portraitofaneditor. And with the code ANTIX20, ANTIX20, you can also get up to 56% off your first subscription or 20 off your one-time purchase. That's ANTIX20, ANTIX20 for 56% off. It also works if you're already a subscriber, you can save on your next subscription payment. So if you're like me and not a big coffee fan and looking for something to keep you focused so you can get through the busy day and stay focused creatively, then I recommend Magic Mind. Once again, it's magicmind.com/portraitofaneditor and get up to 56% off your subscription for the next 10 days with the code ANTIX20, ANTIX20. Dave, thank you for pausing. And one thing you mentioned that I wanted to get back to you was this attitude you had, Western Mass, because I ran into that too. And I've had, you know, conversations over the years about being somebody, you know, a masshole or whatever. But
yeah,
and I ruffled a lot of feathers when I went down to Florida for my grad school, because I was the only New Englander. And everybody else was Midwest or, you know, from the South. And, you know, you moved to New Jersey, so everybody talks fast and everybody has an attitude there. You're going to New York, you know. I mean, I think this area has that, and people, you're swimming in a water. But when you moved to LA, luckily I had my shakedown period, but it was a revelation about sort of what we do regionally and what kind of people we are. And coming back, I saw it. I see it all the time. Coming back, you probably see maybe the difference if you visit here. And you said it sort of, you had to stop and think about it. I mean, what was your experience? Because it does, you know, we don't have a problem with it growing up and as kids, you know, because everybody has that. But what does it do for, you know, but being an editor, it's all about interacting with people. It's all about people skills. You need to be really good at it. But how do you, you know, put your mass hole aside, but there's also some appeal to being, you know, fast talking, opinionated and everything and what we have. And also when we develop friendships, they're rock solid pretty much, you know, we're not, Los Angeles and Florida are very transient. There's a lot of people coming in and leaving, a lot of people starting from scratch and scrambling, trying to find friends. Luckily you moved in with a group of people. I had that opportunity. I had a base, a little bit of a base, but you know, you can see that everybody's sort of trying to connect in Los Angeles. Do you have anything more to say about sort of that attitude change that you had to go through?
Yeah. I mean, it was the biggest shift of my adult life. You know, I grew up in New England. I grew up in Holyoke, Mass, and I love it. And I'm proud of being from there. And I love the people there, and they raised me and they fought for me. And like, when I wanted to be a creative person, it felt like that whole community believed in me. But when I moved, and you know, and going to New Jersey, it has a similar like rough around the edges vibe to it, you know, a very similar type of people to who I grew up with. So even though like I was going from like an Irish and Polish community to a predominantly Italian and Jewish community, the people felt very similar to me. You know, there wasn't a huge gap like in the chip on our shoulder, if you will. But going to Los Angeles, I went from being the most sensitive boy in Western Massachusetts to a guy who was playing a little bit too rough. And you kind of realize, like, oh, we did play really rough as kids and as adults. And, you know, again, like I've talked to a lot of friends, and even the people who are still some of my best friends in Massachusetts had a similar experience of like, we had to grow up and realize that we could put our fists down a little bit. And that, you know, like there was something about being vulnerable and letting people in. And I was always vulnerable as a writer and as a creative person, but I was not always vulnerable as a human being. And, you know, look, like, also be honest, like being in a publishing environment and being in your dream environment is hard because every day you feel like you have to fight to stay. But once I stopped fighting and I was just there and I was just willing to listen and take criticism. And I had a lot of criticism I had to take. I had a lot of growing up I had to do. Like, there was no doubt that I was like smart and creative and I had good ideas, but like there was a lot of edges that needed to get sanded down and work I had to do on myself to really become a fully realized person. And I'm really grateful every day that DC let me grow up there in a really meaningful way. And I had people who believed I was capable of growing up.
I'm trying to put this question together. It's sort of like LA, you know, especially nowadays, people are shitting on LA, but it allowed me to sort of discover other things about myself and my capabilities of being able to accomplish things. I mean, it just feels I had an inner strength and being able to go from just another person who showed up in town to actually climbing a bit of the hill. I felt that I started realizing what I was capable of doing, just making the trip out there, because I did it even before, you know, I went out with a road map, you know, driving through, you know, Route 10 in the middle of Texas, literally in the middle of nowhere with no cell phones. And just the whole process of getting there, settling in, and then rebuilding family, career, and everything. I started realizing what I was capable of doing. What about you?
I mean, one of the reasons why I stay in LA, even though it's not always the easiest place to live, is because like this is the place where I like really figured out who I was, mm-hmm. and the place like I made my dreams come true, and the place where I like became okay with who I was as a person. And you know, I had to do a lot of that on my own. But to go back to the Massachusetts of it all, when I was a kid, I was always saying like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make my dream come true. And then this thing happened where in my early 20s, like I got really discouraged out here. I got beat up pretty bad spiritually. And I talked to my parents or my friends who I grew up with. And I think this is the thing about people from my part of the world that really is great, is like they held me to my dreams. They held me to what I had said as a kid. They were like, you know, Dave, you're the guy who said he was going to make it. You know, you've already gone so far. You got to keep going. And like, you know, it's not that they weren't willing to listen to me cry or like talk about my, having my heart broken. They were. But at the end of the conversation, they were also like, you've come too far to give up. And they were right. And, you know, that's the thing about, that's the best part about Massachusetts. I think I took with me and merged with this LA like progress, is like, I couldn't have climbed the jagged hills of LA without the people I grew up with saying like, you told me that you were going to do this, and I'm going to make sure that you follow through. You know, LA is a special place. Western Mass is a special place. And Holyoke, you know, there's people who really shit on the town I grew up in. You know, I don't know if I can swear. I apologize, but
go ahead.
You know, there were times I came out here and people would go, where are you from? I'd be like, I'm from this place called Holyoke, Mass. They'd be like, oh, that place is a dump. People would look me in the eye and be like, that place is a dump. And I'd be like, hey, pal, that's my dump. And maybe that's something me and Batman have in common with him in Gotham City, is like, that place has its challenges. That place is tough. That place has things that needs to improve. But like, those people took care of me and they raised me and they loved me the best they could. Was it always like gentle love? No, but like, those people got me ready for the world. And, you know, coming from such a hardcore working class part of the world, that's also one of the more like diverse parts of Massachusetts. Like, you know, I have a lot of empathy for people because I grew up in Holyoke, Mass. And I have a tenacity and a work ethic because I grew up there, and because of my family, and because of, you know, my mom being a nurse who woke up at 3 a.m. every day to go to work, and my dad being a traveling salesman by day and a bartender by night who worked his ass off so we could live in a nice house. So, you know, LA made me a more centered, spiritual, calm, fully realized person, but Massachusetts put a fight in me that I wouldn't change for the world.
So you're taking a great deal of the sort of the work ethic that, you know, and just the attitude of that area, of this area that we're both from, like that just pushes you through any of the roughness or any of the sort of setbacks you might have in Los Angeles, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a town that you can go crazy. You know, you come out, it's the only town to like steal from James Ellroy. It's the only town, city in the history of humanity that has ever said, come here and we'll make your dreams come true. You know, you can be famous. And then when people realize that that's not going to happen to me, it's a small, small, small percentage of even doing what either of us have accomplished.
Yeah.
People go a little bit insane, and you can, and I could see it too. I could see it at times. And, you know, but I think having that tenacity that comes from growing up in Holyoke really helps a great deal.
Yeah, and I think there's also a saying about people from the Northeast, like people from the Northeast are kind, but they're not always nice.
Yeah.
And people on the West Coast are nice, but they're not always kind. And there's so many wonderful, lovely people I've met out here, but also like a lot of BS out here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, growing up where I grew up, like I got a pretty good nose for BS, you know? And like, you sit with someone for a couple minutes and you can tell if someone's genuine or not. And you know, I know whether or not to walk away or keep going. And that's something you have to have as an editor as well, to get back to the overall thing. It was like, when you talk to somebody or you hear their ideas, you have to know, like, is this person coming from an authentic and genuine place? Or like, is this person playing some jukebox hits? Mm-hmm. And that's a really important thing to be able to discern talent and story wise.
So it helps with your people skills, basically, but the region you're coming from just enabled you. And then also the education, you know, the sort of revelations you had from LA, it really, it's a perfect combination for being an editor when it comes down to that what you need for people skills.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I've had the fortune of working with some of the best writers and artists like in the world. And I've made a lot of great relationships with those folks. And I think what most of those folks would tell you is like, that guy is honest and he comes from a sincere and earnest place. And those are the weapons I have. Like I don't know if I'm the smartest person. I don't know if I'm the best writer, but like I'm smart. I come from a sincere place. I work hard and I really try to like listen to people and meet them where they are. which is both an LA and a Massachusetts thing. You know, growing up in Massachusetts, you grow up around some people who like don't necessarily know how to speak or know how to articulate themselves, but you know that they have a good heart and you got to maybe go a little bit closer to them than they are willing to go to you to really hear them out. And sometimes that's true of creative people where it's like, I know this person has good ideas. I know this person's talented, but they might be shy. They might be awkward. They might not know how to fully articulate themselves. And like, you got to be willing, especially if they're new, to really help them get out of that place. And empathy and being able to see someone and hear someone is so important in this at this job.
So when was it that you felt, and I know DC had some shakeups, so, and I know people got let go, but
yeah.
I don't know if you were part of that, but when was it, when did you decide it was time to become a freelance writer? Because, you know, LA is not a cheap town anymore. and yeah. I don't think, you know, being, you know, you're probably getting paid all right as an editor, but mm-hmm. still, it can suck your money out in like a one day. You know? And yeah. So taking on a, being a freelancer in comics, knowing what page rates are for a writer, you probably had some thinking to do about it, but, or were you, was your hand forced? I don't, you know.
No, I left with my own volition. Okay. I left with my own volition in 2023, about a year ago. Everybody at DC knew I wanted to go write. And once I had started getting opportunities to do like short stories and then like a couple longer things, like it became a question of not like if I was going to leave, but when, to the point you're making about the economics and financials, because quite frankly, like, no, I for various economic reasons, I wasn't ready to leave, but also I really wanted to leave feeling like I was a good editor and feeling like I had done a good job. And the last couple of years I had at DC, I got to edit like the best books I ever edited. Even though I wanted to be a writer, I didn't want to be remembered as a half-ass editor. So I was getting to write. I wrote short stories. I wrote this Man-Bat miniseries for DC that came out, I believe in 2021. Yeah, 2021. But I knew that like as an editor, I had things I needed to do. I had creators I believed in who I wanted to help, you know, get more eyes on before I left. And then by the end of 2022, I was like, I've done all the projects I was supposed to do as an editor. I'm ready to go. And I was really fortunate because in talking to connections I've made over the years, like I was jumping into freelance writing, but there were people who were like, hey, I have some freelance editing work for you to do if you're willing to do it. So I'm still doing a lot of editing. But this year, just the last 3 months of 2024, the writing has started to come in. So right now, it feels like I'm more balancing editing and writing, where the first year being freelance was all editing and writing pitches that people were like, these are close, but take them back and work on them some more. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, it had to feel right. And it didn't feel right until the end of 22, where I was like, DC's let me write enough things, more than most people had gotten to write in like 10 or 12 years, by the way. Like I was the first editor who got to write stuff in a very, very long time.
How did you, and if it's all right to talk about it, because yeah. the policy, we mentioned that already, there's a policy yeah. about that. How were you able to work around that? Or was it, what is that? Is there a policy or is it just
yeah.
outsider sees about editing?
Yeah. Writing? So basically, you know, I had worked on that crossover Dark Knight's Metal with Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. I was the assistant yep. editor on that. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I'd kind of done all the things you can do as a junior level editor to show that you're ready to kind of move up. But I still had a little bit of growing and learning to do. As I mentioned earlier, my peers were starting to matriculate upward and I wasn't. And I think the company wanted to show like, hey, like, we're not promoting you right now, but like we believe in you and we want to support your career growth, even if it's not as an editor. And Marie Javens, who is now the editor in chief of DC, in a meeting was like, let's let him write. Let's let him write a short story. Like, what can it hurt? Marie had worked at Marvel for many years. She was a colorist while she was on staff at Marvel. And she was just of the belief like, hey, like if his long-term path isn't as an editor, let's see if he can write. And it's one short story. If he does a good job, that's awesome. And if he doesn't, then it doesn't happen again. I was lucky that like I did do a good job and I got to keep doing it. But then they created a space in the anthologies for one story, which I think is appropriate, to have a junior level editor pitch to do a story. So, because I think, you know, to what you were alluding to earlier, the policy changed. I think the policy changed because that was really the time where the lunatics took over the asylum. It was a lot of people giving their friends jobs, helping their buddies go on vacation and build decks on their houses. And it wasn't like, hey, I think that you might actually have some chops as a writer. Why don't you give this a shot? So I think that, you know, the people who gave me the opportunity were very aware of how this went wrong in the 90s. And they were like, we can do this in a very gentle way and, like, you know, not have it be impactful. Because ultimately, the thing that was bad about that time was like, yeah, like, people who deserved opportunities from the outside were not getting them, because people from the inside, who maybe were not supposed to be writing at all, were getting these chances. But I will also say, for me, before I got the chance to write, I was already dedicated to bringing in new people. But again, to talk about that kind of like Massachusetts guilt a little bit, I was like, I'm getting the chance to write. Someone doesn't have this space right now because I do. I need to triple down on giving other people opportunities. If the world is giving me an opportunity that no one's gotten in a long time, I better be paying this forward. And that's another reason I stayed so long, because I liked working with younger writers and artists. I liked fighting for them. I liked helping them find their voice. I liked helping them find their direction. But again, it was always a tightrope walk. Like, I don't think I ever took a job from anybody. You know, I don't think I ever took money out of anybody's pocket. And that was always really important to me. But, you know, also, like, everybody always treated me very fairly as a writer. If I pitched something and they were like, this stinks, like, I wasn't doing it. Like, I didn't just get to write because I was there. I had to always prove I had an idea worthy of getting to write and be published.
Did they put you into with editors who knew you well, or editors who you guys, they strategically give you, opportunities to write with editors that you didn't have that great of a relationship with?
Well, I mean, truth be told, I knew everybody pretty well by that point. Okay. And, you know, the first person I worked with was Alex, who was my co-editor on the anthology. So we were buddies. But I'll tell you something. I don't know if you got the sense about him when you interviewed him, but Alex Antone is one of the most direct and honest people you will ever meet, you know, and which is really great. And so when I pitched to him, he treated me, there were no kid gloves. He was like, hey, if you're going to do this, I'm going to make sure you do a good job and I'm going to not hold back. And he really didn't. So the first couple stories I did were with him. And then the most amount of stories I did were with Andrew Marino, who's a great editor. He's also a great friend. He's someone I came up with at DC at the same time. And we just kind of hit it off magnificently. We did a bunch of Superman and Flash stories together that I couldn't be more proud of.
I see his name all over the new 80 page giants that they're doing.
He does those books now.
They seem to, as with what Alex was doing, they're having a lot of fun with covers and themes and everything, and this wordplay and stuff. Like, what is it, the April? I should be getting that like tomorrow.
The apes, April.
Yeah, I'm like, that's just freaking brilliant of like an excuse to like to publish a 80 page giant in April. And then what is it, spring breakout or summer breakout is the next? No, I think it's spring breakout is the next one.
Spring breakout's the next one. I got to read that one recently. That one's great. Yeah. The last one that I wrote for, I did a Superman story with Riley Rossmo in last year's spring one, which was called Legion of Bloom.
I thought the Legion of Bloom one. I was like, are they going to do that again? That was a great one. I had Mike Perkins did the cover. And
that's right.
I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but yeah, that's a great theme idea. Yeah. So
naming those is the most fun thing in the world. But yeah, those guys took the reins from us, and like they went crazier than we did. Those people are beautiful lunatics.
Yeah, it's just a lot. I don't read a lot of superheroes. I confess that on another earlier podcast. Sure. I'm like, they're just not doing it for me. But those 80 page giants, I like it. It's not so serious. I mean, I'm a huge Punisher fan. So the doom and gloom and darkness of the 90s and everything, I just loved it. But, you know, when Garth Ennis was doing the Punisher as a black comedy, I'm like, this is so perfect for comics. And I'm not saying the 80 page giant are that, but just the attitude of having a sense of humor one way or another about it is the appeal for me personally. I just feel that don't take yourself so seriously.
You know? I think you have to have a sense of humor about this genre, but every genre. My brother, by the way, also a huge Punisher and Garth Ennis fan, so you're in good company. But one of the philosophies with those anthologies is like, hey, we're going to have fun. The most important thing, though, is like we treat the characters with respect, and we ground them in truth, and like we treat all the stories like they could happen. Like every story could happen in continuity. Like we told people, like, don't break the toy. Don't like put a retcon in there. Don't try to change history. But like, just take these instructions and like try to tell a great story. I don't know what Alex's perspective was, but my perspective was like growing up a huge fan of sitcoms. Like I just treated them like the holiday episode you got every year of a sitcom where it's like, hey, Homer is, the Santa Claus at the mall this year, or Bart steals a video game and it breaks Marge's heart. Like, you just try to use the holidays as a real springboard for emotional storytelling. And, you know, you have to get a couple jokes in during the holidays. You're going to go crazy.
And I think it's not like, oh, it's only 10 pages, because they're also layered. The one I read of one of yours that I read with, it had Blue Beetle and Booster Gold, the chibi characters.
That was the Legion of Bloom one. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what you sent me, and I'm like, but I know there's a whole story behind this, and just seeing, you know, how they're depicted, I'm like sort of laughing at them and just having, oops, yeah, we made a mistake with this one, but there's something else going on in that story, but then we're moving on because it's just like, and then we have another story following it up. So it's just so much fun, you know. Yeah, it's amazing what you can do with short stories. And I mean, what do you think of short stories, I guess?
I think they're the best. I've done 18 of them now. And like, if you can do a short story, you can do anything. And I mean that really sincerely, like, especially an 8 or 10 page story, like you really have to, like, you either have a story or you don't. And you know by page 2 if this person actually knows what they're doing or not. And you know, I love writing short stories. I hope I always get to do them, but like, I'm such a better writer for having written so many of them. And as the editor, I edited not only those anthologies of Alex Antone, but I edited so many Secret Files or the Batman Urban Legends book with short stories. Like, I just think short stories are such a great way to test talent. Also, you know, on those anthologies, because they would have like really, like they would have all of the DC Universe characters, no matter how weird, it was fun to like go to somebody and be like, hey, your first DC job is going to be the Atom or Red Tornado, kind of like in the 60s, you know? So I think the short story is a great way to prove that you have what it takes. As an artist, it's a great format to, you know, make sure that you can hit a monthly schedule. And just in general, like, if you can get someone's attention with a short story, you can certainly do a full issue. You can certainly do a full arc. You can do an annual. You can do anything, I think.
So let's... we've been all over the place on this one, but one question, now that you're pursuing the writing, what is the thing that you learned as an editor that you feel, is there one or two things as you're coming up as an editor that you will carry with you in your writer that makes you a better writer and allows you to maintain, you know, that you think will carry you through as you pursue your freelance career?
Be kind and take criticism, you know, like I've when you get notes, you bristle sometimes because you're like, oh, I thought I took something out of my brain that was perfect. And when you get a note, in my experience anyway, sometimes it hurts your feelings and you got to let your feelings be hurt for a couple minutes. And then you have to go, okay, but now I have to take this note. And 99.9% of the time, like, especially with the editors I've worked with who are all great, every note I've ever taken has made me a better writer. And because of that, like every time I get a note now, it like my ego is hurt a little less because I'm excited now to get notes and to take criticism to make something better. Cause like I've learned that, like, you know, there may be geniuses in this world. I'm not one of them. I might have a good idea, but I've never had an idea that wasn't improved by another person giving me good notes. And then the second thing, especially as a comic book writer, is like, you got to write comics that people want to draw. And I've worked with so many phenomenal comic artists, especially guys like Riley Rossmo, Jorge Corona, Mike Norton. And you know, comics is a visual medium. And going back to my experience on Word Balloon, I would listen to interviews with people and they would talk about drawing comics, which is like a grueling job. And they'd be like, yeah, I'm not really enjoying drawing like the comic I'm working on right now. And it broke my heart. This is the best job in the world. And like, I don't know if I always succeed at it, but I try to make sure that I write things that people want to draw or are excited to draw. You know, and there's been a lot of arguments about that over the years. Like people are like, oh, this person just wrote a bunch of splash pages. Writing something someone wants to draw doesn't mean just writing a bunch of splash pages or two or three panel pages. It means like sitting with the person you're working with and like looking at their work and writing something based on what you think they do best and talking to them and being like, what do you want to do? What do you not want to do? And also being a good collaborator and putting in the script. Hey, I got some stuff here. If you have a better idea, let's do it. And being flexible. So I guess both things are ultimately being flexible with the people you're working with.
Well, hey, Dave, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah.
Now I really want to get back to Los Angeles. But if you ever come out here and visit, I'm just down 91, basically, so, outside of Hartford.
I know it well. Well, hey, listen, thank you so much for having me. And like I said before we started recording, like, I can't tell you what it means to have people interview editors. Like, most people don't know what editors do, and I think the work you're doing is so cool. And like I said, you've had a lot of my friends on the show, and they spoke very highly of you. And this was a really great time. It's also my first ever podcast interview, so thank you for having me. It means a great deal.
Well, I hope my questions were too bad.
They were excellent. We talked much more about Massachusetts than I thought, but I think we got it to come back around to comics pretty effectively.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Well, you're welcome. Thank you very much for the kind words. Thank you. It's just something I like doing, and it gives me a chance to talk about comics. So,
and absolutely,
a few people listen to it at times. So, but thank you very much.
All right, you got it. Thank you so much. I would love to do this again.
Sounds like a plan.